or 12 Celsius. Further south, though, and east, highs of 14 degrees and 15 for Belfast. On Thursday, the next area of low pressure hurtles in off the Atlantic, bringing a day of cloud, wind and rain to most parts of the UK, temperatures ranging from 11 to 17 degrees. But on Friday, low pressure clears away eastwards to leave high pressure building, so a mostly fine, dry and settled day with some sunny spells and light winds. And into the weekend, high pressure remains in control. It stays settled with sunny spells and feeling warmer for all.
Thanks a lot, Stav. Now on Radio 4, it's time for our Book of the Week, a cautionary tale of poison, betrayal and greed. On the 2nd of November 1833, Dr. John Butler was called to the Bodle family's farmhouse in Plumstead, where everyone had been taken seriously ill. He suspected that they were the victims of arsenic poisoning. Gillian Rind Tutt reads from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel.
The Bodles were suffering horribly, but at least they were spared leeches and the stomach pump. In the 19th century, bloodletting was one of the most common treatments for suspected cases of poisoning. Other favourite remedies at the time included milk, vinegar, linseed, copious amounts of sugar and water, and tickling the back of the patient's throat with the fingers or a feather. The aim was to make the patient throw up the deadly matter as quickly and copiously as possible. When John Butler had finished examining his patients that Saturday night, however, he prescribed nothing more harmful than egg whites and castor oil, both standard treatments at the time. The typical practice was to administer 12 to 15 eggs beaten in 2 pints of water every 2 or 3 minutes. The Bodle women followed Butler's orders, but old George was having none of it. Probably wanting to assuage a raging thirst and burning throat, he ignored the doctor's unpalatable advice and drank a pint of ale instead. Early the next day, Sunday, the 3rd of November, the surgeon was back at the Plumstead farmhouse. 4 of his patients, although still very sick and weak, were showing signs of improvement. The farmer, however, was much worse. Butler now decided that he was out of his depth with George Bodle. The time had come for a second opinion. For him, the obvious man to consult was the veteran local physician, Dr. Thomas Sutton, a former army doctor and consultant to the charity, the Kent Dispensary. As a member of the elite Royal College of Physicians, Sutton was at the top of the medical hierarchy. Unfortunately, in this case, Sutton had no innovative treatment to suggest. His younger colleague was already doing all that could be done, medically speaking. Hoping and praying were all that was left. By the next morning, Tuesday, the 5th of November, it was clear that the farmer had not much longer to live. Mrs. Lear stayed at her nursing post. She found it a trying scene to sit watching over the poor old man, now in no doubt that life was ebbing out of him, and she listened as he prayed fervently to the God he had served all his life. He was still saying his prayers when his wife, very sick and frail herself, crept into the bedroom to say goodbye. He said, "You are come," and seemed pleased, Mrs. Lear said. He had no strength to keep up a conversation, but the couple prayed together. Middle John was at his father's bedside on Tuesday, and it was while he was huddled next to George in the dim light of the late afternoon that, according to him, the old man had whispered into his ear, confessing his suspicions as to how his righteous life had been brought to such a sad and painful end. For the time being, Middle John told no one what passed between them, and he left the farmhouse at around 4 to go back to his cottage for tea. No sooner had he reached home, however, than a servant came running down the path, saying that the old man was near his end. Middle John hurried back. I entered the room before he was quite gone, for I put my hand under his chin to prevent it falling, he said. My father kissed me and said, "God bless you," in a very faint voice. That night, the surgeon was called to the house again. This time, though, it was to examine the racked body of an old man and to confirm that life was indeed extinct. This last duty done, the doctor left the weeping Mrs. Lear as she laid out her master's corpse and headed his carriage back towards Woolwich in search of a magistrate. The healers of the sick could do no more. Now it was the turn of His Majesty's criminal justice system, for John Butler was convinced this death was no accident. The entire success of a criminal poisoning depends on the process imitating the effects of a natural disease. So said Edinburgh's Professor of Forensics, Robert Christison. If he was right, then in 1833, the odds ran strongly in the murderer's favour, because so many diseases were poorly understood. At this time, doctors had nothing to go on but the symptoms and the circumstances leading to those symptoms. In the autumn of 1831, a disease had appeared in northeast England, the like of which had never been seen before in Britain. For 5 years, Asiatic cholera had been making its way steadily out of India, northwest through the Russian Empire, and across Europe. In its severest form, cholera is one of the fastest killer diseases known to man, and a victim can die within 2 hours of the onset of symptoms. No one understood how the disease was transmitted, so no one knew how to prevent its spreading. In fact, it is mainly spread through contaminated water, but this idea was unheard of at the time. And while there were countless bizarre and sometimes fatal remedies on offer, including slapping hot poultices smeared with irritants such as mustard onto patients' stomachs, pouring boiling water over their feet, giving them draughts of medicine containing mercury, ammonia, or turpentine, and, of course, bleeding, nothing seemed to work. Within 12 months, 32,000 people had died. The symptoms, violent vomiting and diarrhea, agonizing cramps, the skin turning dark blue or black, and a rapid physical decline, mimicked both the severest cases of English cholera and also of arsenic poisoning. The Lancet predicted more trouble for the criminal justice system. In poisoning trials, the defence often claimed that the cause of death was not arsenic at all, but the ordinary species of cholera. In trying to firm up a diagnosis, the medical profession had tended to use the rule of thumb that patients with English cholera, as opposed to arsenic poisoning, had no blood in their stools or vomit, and that the disease was never fatal in less than 12 hours. Asiatic cholera rendered this distinction useless. John Butler's night call at the residence of the Reverend Dr. Watson, J.P., marked the start of the criminal investigation into how George Bodle had died. When the magistrate heard what John Butler had to say, he decided to inform the coroner. In the meantime, John Butler returned to the Bodle's farmhouse to continue with some investigations of his own. It would be another 9 years before the Metropolitan Police's Detective Department, the forerunner to the CID, was set up. So in 1833, it fell to the first medical man on the scene to seize anything that might be considered useful evidence and to note any suspicious circumstances. As science advanced in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the authorities began to appreciate that matter such as the victim's stomach contents, leftover food, drink, and medicine, had a tale to tell. And to interpret the evidence, they relied on both doctors and analytical chemists. The Bodle investigation was fortunate in that John Butler realized he had a key part to play in uncovering what he was increasingly convinced was a murder. When Butler had first arrived at the farm that Saturday night, he had set about questioning the family. He then turned his attention to the scientific evidence, Judith Lear was instructed to save a specimen of George's vomit. In cases where the patient had stopped vomiting by the time the doctor arrived, perhaps because the patient was now dead, the eminent toxicologist Alfred Swain Taylor advised that the sick room be searched for stains. When Butler learnt of the ritual of the coffee pot, he sent Judith Lear hot foot down the road to her daughter Mary Bing's house to see whether, by chance, any trace of that coffee remained. He was in luck. Earlier that day, Mrs. Lear had sent an urgent message to the Bings not to touch the jug she had left on their kitchen table. Next on the surgeon's list was the dry coffee that was kept locked in the parlour cupboard. On the fateful morning, after the maid Sophia had used the last of the coffee for breakfast, the bottle had been refilled. Butler explained, "I therefore inverted the bottle and allowed the coffee gradually to run out, and I found adhering to the bottom a coating of old coffee, about 1/8 of an inch thick, and of a different colour to that which I had turned out." He removed what he could of the coffee crust and took it away with him, along with the coffee pot recovered from the Bings' cottage. He handed these over for analysis to James Marsh, assistant to Michael Faraday, Professor of Chemistry at the nearby Royal Military Academy. With George's death, the stories already circulating in the village of Plumstead, and especially in the Plume of Feathers, the Prince of Orange and the Green Man, reached new and delicious heights. In this small community, news travelled fast. Early on the morning of Wednesday, the 6th of November, Middle John and Samuel Baxter, George's son-in-law, were huddled in conversation on the drive of the farmhouse. Middle John said that his servant Mary Higgins had overheard young John claiming he had murdered his grandfather, and that there was another that was wanted out of the way as well, and that was his own father, Middle John. Whatever had gone on at Bodle's farm, something was clearly amiss, and Baxter decided that they had a duty to report the rumours. Young John had left Plumstead the previous day, a few hours before his grandfather died, and was staying with his sister Mary Andrews and her husband Thomas in Clerkenwell. Middle John and his friends walked to the home of the Reverend Dr. Watson, where Middle John again recounted his story of how young John had boasted about murdering his grandfather and was now plotting to kill him. Meanwhile, John Watts, a friend of young John's and the schoolmaster at Kipling's Charity School, was already being questioned. Watts told the magistrate that 2 weeks earlier, at about 7 in the evening, he had gone with young John to Joseph Evans' chemist's shop in Powers Street, Woolwich, where his friend had bought 2 packets of arsenic. Accordingly, Watson wrote a note to P.C. James Morris, a very active constable, according to the Maidstone Gazette, dispatching him to Clerkenwell to take young John Bodle into custody. Events in Plumstead now began to move fast. A terrified Mary Higgins was brought before Watson for questioning, while Constable Morris duly climbed aboard the omnibus for London, an arrest warrant in his tunic pocket. At the same time, as the law demanded, a body of 17 good and lawful local men convened as a coroner's jury in the large upstairs room at the Plume of Feathers.
Julian Rhind-Tutt was reading from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel, abridged by Libby Spurrier. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. The producer was David Blount. And the story of the infamous Plumstead murder case of 1833 continues at the same time tomorrow, when the inquest into the death of old George Bodle captures the imagination of the nation. The Shipping Bulletin is next here on BBC Radio 4, and to take us there, as you'd expect, it's this. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday the 18th of September 2013. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, Dover, White, Portland, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low just northwest of Viking 980, slow moving, filling 990 by 1800 Wednesday. Low, southeast England 994, moving away rather quickly eastwards. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Southwest Viking, westerly or southwesterly 5 to 7, squally.